First, I want to thank Susan and Amanda for putting together this group of people and this symposium about caterpillars. And I think that, needless to say, Winnie and I feel that caterpillars have been neglected substantially, probably because you can't put them on a pin. I think that's the real reason why caterpillars have been neglected. Well, let's see now. Let's try this one. Doesn't seem to want to go forward. Amanda, you got any brilliant ideas? I was trying to... That's pretty brilliant, isn't it? Yeah. I was trying to make it go backwards. We're focused on who eats what in a tropical forest. Now, where is this tropical forest? It's that little yellow spot down there around the bottom end of the slide. And it's the same size as that yellow spot you see up there in the middle of North America. I want to emphasize that there's a lot of species packed into this little chunk of terrain. 4% of the world's biodiversity is sitting on the yellow spot. Now, to put this in a bigger context, that's the amount of biodiversity sitting in that big yellow spot up there. Now, the specific piece of the yellow spot where Winnie and I are doing this is called the ACG, or the Área de Conservación Guanacaste. And it's that yellow thing up there in the upper left-hand corner. And if you do the same kind of thing for that, for Costa Rica, 65% of Costa Rica's biodiversity occurs in this little yellow spot, which, if we go back to it, is the size of New York City and its suburbs, or Philadelphia and its suburbs, any big U.S. city and its suburbs in area. And in that area are four of the five major tropical ecosystems. The one that's missing is desert. So it was cloud forest, marine, we don't worry about marine caterpillars, and rainforest and dry forest. And this is what it looks like in a sort of 3D model. The Pacific out there is obvious at the bottom of the picture. Dry forest is the coastal plain, then the cloud forest, or what remains of it, is from climate change, is still on the tops of the volcanoes, and then you go down into the Caribbean rainforest on the other side. So we're talking about finding, or attempting to find, all of the caterpillars, their food plants, and their parasitoids in that chunk of terrain, as I say, the size of New York City and its suburbs. For linear things, it's 85 kilometers long, if you want some feeling for linear measurements. Now, when we started, this was sort of the view that we had. And this is the kind of view we have about caterpillars in most of the tropics. Most of the tropics, you step off the plane, you find a big green worm, you have no idea what it is, and nobody can tell you what it is. And that's where we were stuck. Same with the parasites as well. So in one sense, we were starting blind, you know, like landing on a new planet. On the other hand, there's an enormous amount of collecting of adults that's gone on. And you know there's a caterpillar behind every adult. So we know, in this peculiar kind of inventory, we know there's at least 10,000 species of moths and butterflies in that area. Even though we don't know what they are and we don't know where they are, but we know they're there because of the adults, we know that there's that many kinds of caterpillars in the system. So we're doing inventory not totally blind as you would as Audubon was when he got off the boat in North America. And the people who are doing this work, so Winnie and I can stand up here and talk to you about it, are parataxonomists, and there are 24 of them. And it's 24 careers. These are not graduate students. They're not Peace Corps people. They're not undergraduates on a summer project. They're people who are making their livelihood doing this. They're married. They have children. The kids are off to school. Well, it's a life that they're carrying out, producing the data that we're talking about here today. And they're all, if you like, residents. They're all people who grew up there. Grandma's over here and mother's over there, and they married the girl next door, and that sort of stuff. We're not talking about people who've come into this area. And what do they actually do? They spend their time looking for caterpillars, very simply. They find them, Ruth's up on the top of that ladder getting something that she found the turds on the ground underneath, and she's got the caterpillar there in her hand. It goes into a plastic bag, and it goes into a rearing barn. It's very, very simple. This is very low tech. And each one of those bags has got its own individual caterpillar, and I think all you realize that that's just an enormous babysitting operation. These small things go in bottles, and the tops are not screwed on top. The tops are loosely placed on the top, which serves as a kind of an in-between, a sealed and a not sealed container. You have to have them loose, or otherwise the decomposing material in the bottle often ends up killing a caterpillar. So little things in bottles, big things in plastic bags. And eventually something emerges, as you can see over here on the left side. If I can just scoop this around to there, you get big things like this, or you get little things like this. And those bottle caps up there give you some idea of the small end of the scale. We do not deal with leaf miners. That's for somebody else, another generation. And that then produces product. I'm being very literal in using that word. It's an assembly line, an industrial level operation, and the product is adults. And you notice that every one of those bits of product has got a little white tag associated with it. On that tag is a, in fact, you can see them on there. You can see the individual codes right there. That's the voucher code that goes with that specimen. And on this bag, there's the voucher code there that goes with this specimen. So every one of those individual products has got its own individual voucher code and stays with it for life. And the parasites as well. But if there were 8 flies out of 1 caterpillar, they all get the same voucher code, because really the voucher code is the event of finding the caterpillar. And then subsequently it gets another voucher code later on if we do something individually with that parasitoid. And then finally there's the plants that these guys are eating. And these are worked on by quite an array of both plant parataxonomists and hardcore taxonomically oriented botanists. And as you can see in that photograph, we're not dealing with plants with fruits and flowers for the most part. We're dealing with lots of juvenile plants, lots of sterile plants. And so it's an enormous task of figuring out accurately what are the names of the plants that go with these individual caterpillars. But it can be done. And then the pin specimens go in regular old Schmidt boxes. They go in the overhead compartment on an airplane, and they're hand-carried back to Pennsylvania. As you can see, they're tied up with a string. That's no packing, just carried in hand with all the usual export permits and research permits associated. So after 30 years of doing this, where are we? We're at 335,000 records at the moment, 143,000 images of these caterpillars and the adults on the web now. That's about 3,800 species of moths and butterflies and about 2,350-odd species of food plants. So that's the degree of complexity. And that group of parataxonomists is generating about 35,000 rearing records a year. And they're doing the whole thing. All I get is product and quality control and try to figure out analysis and how to get the information out. And what Winnie does is all of this stuff as well. But she's also responsible, as you heard earlier, for the website, which we keep trying to be up. And incidentally, it's completely public domain. Your tax dollars paid for it, because NSF is paying the bill. As far as they're concerned, you own it. Now, it creates this kind of a process. That's a stack of events. Each one of those records is one event of finding one caterpillar. Now, many die of disease, many die of parasites, many die of maltreatment, what have you. And so what you have is all these records, and then some of them have a specimen attached. Some of them have a photograph attached, all right? So this is not starting with the world as a museum drawer. It's starting with the world as the living thing out there in the field. So there's this cycle. From you find the caterpillar up there in the new leaves, it goes into a lab, the parataxonomists photograph it, they database it, ranks a record, it goes into a computer and goes out into your head. That's the loop. And our goal is, our attempted goal, is to find all the caterpillars in this place before we die and get them on the web. Okay. This is what the website looks like. You can put a name over here on the left side, for example, if you know the names. Other ways, obviously, to work this website and get a list of the food plants that we know to date. Or you can get the photographs that go with it. You can get high-resolution photographs of those images of the thumbnails you saw earlier. And you can get the adults that go with them. So this is the basic output. Right? So we're trying to go from something that looks like this, exceedingly blurry vision of the system, to something that's got a lot more resolution. Obviously, it could get yet more resolution than we've been able to achieve. So what happens when you do this? What happens when you inventory a big, complicated place through the lens of the caterpillar, not through the lens of the butterfly net or the lens of the black light sheet and all that? Well, the first thing that happens is you find a lot of things nobody knew were there. A good example is this Opsiphanes up there at the top. That's as big as my hand. It's a specimen, it's a species never encountered in Central America before, and yet if you go out and you find the caterpillars, I have never seen an adult of this thing in nature, only in plastic bags. It turns out to be a South American species, of which there were 5 specimens, all males known. Now we know what the female looks like, too, because we reared them from the caterpillars. The bottom four skippers that you see here were completely uncollected. Now, Costa Rica has been collected intensively with butterfly nets for 200 years. These four species all co-occur in the same place, were never seen. I have seen one individual in nature in my entire life, and we've reared perhaps 1,000 of them in plastic bags. Now, the other side of the coin is this. These are common moths from a black light sheet, right in the middle of our intense rearing area, and we can't find the caterpillars. We know they're there because you get the adults all the time. These are not migrants. These are residents. We can't find the caterpillars. The one on the upper left, Atimaris ganascus, everybody, oh, I've seen that on the sheet all the time. And in fact, we've reared a whole lot of things that look exactly like it, Atimaris daphne. But it turns out when you barcode them and look at the two, ganascus and daphne are different. We've found a ton of caterpillars of daphne, none of ganascus. Obviously, the ganascus is, obviously, very likely it's in the very top of a tree somewhere. And we just haven't gotten to it yet. Now, let's look at some of the characteristics of the caterpillars that sort of leap out at you. The very first one that hits you when you're processing lots of tropical caterpillars is eye spots. They're everywhere. These are three entirely different families, a skipper, a sphingid, and a notodontid. And it just goes on and on and on. There are literally hundreds and hundreds of them. So you puzzle and you think and you wonder, and who's the selection for all this? Well, let's take it this way. You're a 3-gram bird, and you want to live 20 years. And you're foraging for insects down in the shady, dappled leaves, windy, moving, shifting in the middle of a bush. And you come around a leaf, and that's staring you in the face. If you stop to look and see if that is a predator or an edible, you're dead. You're lunch. So you have to have the reaction, gone. Now, are you going to stop 2 meters out and say, I wonder if I was right or I wonder if I was wrong, and I go back in and look again? Of course you're not. The predator system has to be hardwired to say no when there's an eye spot. And I said hardwired. I didn't say learned. Okay? Now, if we just accept that hypothesis for the moment, that these predators are in fact hardwired to avoid this generic thing called an eye spot, what's the implication for that? It says a whole lot of things, because obviously some birds are going to be stupidly hardwired, some are going to be in between hardwired, and some are going to be, well, now wait a minute, I'm going to just back off 6 inches and look because I'm real quick. So there's a whole series of possibilities, but all you have to do is have some hardwiring in there and immediately have strong selection for anything with a dot in it to turn into an eye spot. Now, if you take that model, that way of going at selection, let's move on to this stuff. There are jillions of mimics in the system. And in the caterpillars, in the caterpillars there are jillions of mimics. The thing on the left there, those are all that color pattern, red at each end, a little bit of red underneath, and black and white on the back. At least I have at least 250 species of caterpillars with that color pattern. The thing on the right, you see all those spiny urticating things on the right? None of those are spiny and urticating. There's a bucket load of mimics in here. Now, the traditional way of going at these color patterns is to think in terms of, you know, monarch butterflies and Lincoln Brower's blue jays. I mean, that's perfectly reasonable, and I'm sure that works in the system. But everything I see says in here that we have a big batch of predators who are genetically hardwired to never touch any of these sets. And immediately that changes the whole nature of the evolutionary paradigm for these color patterns. Now you say, well, wait a minute, that sounds pretty speculative, and that's just hot air. Well, look at the bottom row here. Susan Smith, 25 years ago, showed unambiguously that medium-sized tropical birds, grown up, never seen anything brilliant color in it, were hardwired to avoid ringed colors, period. Put the stripes on them, they take them. Put a ringer on it, won't touch it. I had a baby owl rid the same way. Wouldn't touch these Ithomiine butterflies that all of us think are the things that are part of a learning mimicry system. It had never seen a butterfly in its life, and it would not touch a Helicoidine or an Ithomiine, and gobbled up every other kind of lep you can think of. Those things on the caterpillars that you see there are a great mix of aposomatic, in classical terms, aposomatic and non-aposomatic. They're edibles and non-edibles. Look at the one on the far right up there. That's the same caterpillar 4 days apart. Upper right-hand corner is Pachylia sicis. When it's feeding on the leaves, 4 days later, it decides to go prepupal, walk down the tree. It's not a molt now. Walk down the tree, walk across the ground, and find a pupation site. Turns into a coral snake. That thing is not being protected by some bird who learned by through trial and error. That thing is getting away with this because there's a hardwired program out there in a set of predators. These are the predators. There's a Trogon. That's Trogon diet brought to the kids. How many ringed caterpillars do you see on that plate? These guys are living in a world full of brilliantly ringed caterpillars. They never touch them. Well, as soon as you have that kind of selection going on, it changes the whole nature of selection for color patterns. There they are. Now you say, oh, I've got to figure out which ones are edible and can the birds learn and how long do the birds remember and all this. I don't think that's going on at all. I think what we've got is a whole set of predators out there that are selecting for these color patterns. These are straight out mimicry patterns. You can whether call them baits, you can call them Eulerian, you can call them mixes as you like, but the paradigm is not the learning paradigm. It's a hardwired one. Now let's look at food plans. That's the thing that John Lill was just talking about. I don't want to go on about it very much because I'm not going to just touch on what's coming out of the inventory. But if we just look at specificity and breadth, this is a generalization, and I have to go family by family because as soon as you lump them together, you get garbage in my way of thinking. These are nymphalidae. I have 111 in the dry forest. We have 111 species of nymphalidae that we've reared a lot of so far, and that's the number of plant families they feed on up there in those lines. The yellow ones are the biggies, the fives, the fours. Well, you can see how many there are. There's seven species of nymphalid out of 111 who feed on four or five families. One of them is our good old friend, the Morphos. Another one is Archaeopropona. Another one is Lycaria, who eats latex-filled plants. And the bottom four are just eating broad-leafed families of monocots, i.e., they're very specific and they're very specialized. Very different pattern than we get up here. Now we go to another one. These are Saturniids. So I have 40 species of dry forest Saturniids in this place. Look at what's happened to the pattern. All of a sudden, we got a bunch of acting like John Lill's Limacodids. Now, if I did Limacodids, we get the pattern that he got. We can go the other direction, Rhyodenids, for example, Skippers, for example, and the line across there is practically all ones. And in fact, if you go down to genera, it's almost all ones as well. So what happens is, family by family, there's differences. And they range all the way from extremely specialized all the way up to extremely generalist. And what happens to the parasitoids in that system? Well, this is Tachinid flies done the same way. And there are 400, there are obviously not 420 numbers there, but the number system is repeated like that if you just keep going for 420 species all in one place now. And what you get is a whole lot of ones. 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. But you can see the yellow ones in there. There are 16 yellows in there, big chunks where one parasite has got a long list of caterpillars. So now this is, remember, I haven't said a word about barcoding yet, all right? This is taxonomically done the way I've grown up on, right? Morphology and natural history of the host plants and the host caterpillars. Long series, we out of the inventory, we get a long series of good specimens. We got co-authorships, we got a lot of taxonomists working on this stuff. But the weak point in that is there is no escape from the parasitic mutualism between the ecologist and the taxonomist. Me as an ecologist, I would like to take all the taxonomists and aim them at all the things that would help me. They would like to take me and aim me at getting all the material they want, right? So we live in this sort of uneasy, mutualistic, parasitic relationship and have done so for the last 25 years, okay? So how do we democratize that? How do we turn that into a win-win situation that's much more universal? Well, take your blurry photograph that looks like that, and this is where we want to go now, and this is where we are now, but in 2003, we discovered a way to sharpen that image even more, the image that we're looking at there. Because this guy right there had this insane thought that Paul Hébert had this insane thought that we could take a little snippet of that DNA genome and use it as a tool for telling species apart. And as you know, many of you fell on his head and said, oh, the most stupidest thing in the world, and da-da-da, outrageous, and da-da-da-da-da. And my reaction as an ecologist, which I think some of you know, was to take this box, this is the box of butterflies, and give it to him and say, Paul, can you tell these things apart? That's a horrible, that looks like easy over there. That's a horror, taxonomically, morphologically, okay? And 2 weeks later, he said, oh, he has no problem at all. We can tell them all apart, no problem. Well, it's doing using that little snippet of the CO1 gene, which I won't dwell on here. And that's what a real barcode looks like, just in case none of you have ever actually seen one. That's a think of that as a 650-letter word. Notice I didn't say a 200-letter word. I didn't say a 300-letter word. I just said a 650-letter word. And the standard that's being pushed right now is 500. I don't like 500s. I like 650s, i.e. a long word, okay, made up of four letters. Now what happens when you add, as you can see now, it's the same thing you saw earlier, but now there's a barcode sequence over here added on to some of those specimens. Well, I think I won't even spend hardly any time on this. This was the first case that we tried out, if you like, with a Strapti's Fulgurator, and which were basically impossible morphologically. My goodness gracious, look at that. Anyway, the whole point was that they eat some ridiculous number of 17 food plant families and 51 species. Actually, that number's gone up now, which is nonsense. So we took legs off anywhere one of those. We barcoded them all, and it's area again. You can't. What happened was, you can't see the list behind this, but what happened was this enormously long list of hosts dissolved into lumps, and each lump matched a barcode very well. And when you looked at the caterpillars, it was a no-brainer. That the caterpillars went along with the food plants and they went along with the adults when you started them out and looked at them carefully. End of story. There were 10 species. Now it's 11. We found another one in the same place in Strapti's Fulgurator in one spot by barcoding them and joining it to morphology and joining it to the food plant, caterpillar morphology, color pattern, and the food plants. The point is, it works. So what we're really talking about is the dream, and I can say to you all, we're all working towards that dream, and I like to say within 5 years, other people say within 10 years, you'll be carrying something in your back pocket that will allow you to do this on the spot. We'll see. Now, the idea, of course, is to take all of this group of people, all of these people here, and collapse them down into this little machine, okay? That's the idea. Get them into your back pocket, all right? So that's the concept. Well, what happens when you do that? This is a sort of quick summary of where we are right now. And to read these numbers, you see it says Braconidae and says morphology breaks up. This is how many of a set of species of Braconids that we looked at that were morphologically thought of as one thing broke up into something else. Into more things when you barcoded them. And how many over here in this column, over here on this side, is how many cases where there are two morphological entities which are not distinguishable by their barcode. And you can see the groups over here, and you can see what over, you can look at those numbers and compare them for yourself. I don't have to read them to you. Out of the total, that thing on the far right over there is the total number of species looked at, morphological species over there, that 295, 712, blah, 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 on the other. Anyway, the point I want to make to you is that when you barcode a thing you're very familiar with, remember, these are animals we've been now working with for years and years and years, you discover a whole bunch of things that you didn't know were there. I'll leave it right at that. So people say, if I have a good taxonomist, I don't need all that sort of stuff. There is not one living person on the planet who can look at this slide and identify all of those butterflies. Everyone's had a name for at least 50 to 100 years. I repeat, Andy Warren can't do it, Olaf Mielke can't do it, nobody can do it, all right? I can do every one of them with 100% accuracy for $2.50. Now you say, but they're dingy little black skippers that are really hard to tell apart. And if I did the genitalia, then I could tell. That's right. And what's the cost of doing the genitalia? Much greater than $2.50. But you say, but those are the dingy things. Well, what about the pretty ones? I'll bet you $1,000 there isn't one person on a planet who can identify each one of those butterflies morphologically, looking at them. Not one person. I can do every single one of them with a barcode. The point is not that morphology doesn't work. It's just that barcoding gives you much more resolution when you add it to your morphology. Or this kind of a problem. Anybody want to tell me what the one in the middle matches? It's real easy when you barcode them. That's two genera of skippers, four species. Now, what happens overall when you take one fauna that you're working on and you split them up this way? Well, right now, down in the lower left, down it says 13% increase in Lepidoptera. That's over this set of things, the families that you see up there on the top, skippers, noctuids, saturniids, finches, and nymphalids, we have a 13% increase in one place where we already know the fauna very, very well. Okay, bird guides, I mean butterfly guides and so on over it. For the parasitoids in that place, there's a 51% increase in species. We effectively, you know, another 50% added to it. The difference between butterflies and parasites is not surprising. Butterflies are big, they wear billboards on their wings, so people are easy to tell them apart, and people have worked on them a lot. Obviously, parasites are small, inconspicuous, and the selection isn't working on them the same way it is on butterflies in terms of visible traits. I'm going to skip over this slide and go to the next one and show you a real example how this actually works. This is the genus Obsiphenes. These are the reared ones that wouldn't occur where I am. And when you barcode the set, that's an NJ tree there with one male to go with each one of the lumps in the barcode tree. There they are, very straightforward. You can tell them all apart, no problem at all. And you can tell them apart morphologically as well. Very well-known group of butterflies. You catch them with bait traps, okay? Real simple. Well, notice that right down here, the bottom, whoops, I goofed it. See if I can recover from that just a minute here. There we go. Right down at the bottom, there we go, right down there, is a little lump, sort of a wobble. See, right down in there, a little lumpy thing. And we have learned to be very suspicious of little things like that, especially when there's a full-length sequence associated with it. And they are. These are 657 base pair barcodes. Well, you go and you take that little lump down there and you look at the specimens that actually contributed. And this, one thing incidentally barcoding does to you, it turns you into a museum. Because you find yourself saying, oh my God, I have to save every single specimen because you want to go back and look at it again. When you look at that, you suddenly discover that butterfly, it looks superficially like the one just above it, like Cassini, in whose lump it's sitting. But you can see, I think, the slight difference in the wing. Look at the forewing in the center of the forewing. You'll see that the little orange wiggle is separate from the band on the side. And you go and you look at the girls that go with it, and you suddenly discover that the female is very different. The female of the normal one is at the top, the white one, the white wings. She's got white. The female wasn't known of this thing until we reared it. The point is, it leaps out at you with its barcode. It's been overlooked God knows how long, and I have no idea how many of these are going to show up in collections now when we go back and look in Obsiphenes collections for that one little wiggly trait. And that's turns out to be a new species of Obsiphenes. Say, well, that one is, you know, that's got a morphological trait that I can see. Yeah, uh-huh. Okay, well, look at this one. This is a Proponolarity. It's a very common butterfly to fruit. And you can see that on the left, there's two blocks. They're red and blue. And on the left, the blue one, sorry, is one lump of barcodes, and the red one is another lump. Now, this is a butterfly everybody knows. We've reared a jillion of them. But what always bothered me about the rearing data was that half of them are from, we've over 200. Half of them are off of Chrysobalanaceae, and the other half are off of Fabaceae. When you barcode them, they turn out to be two different animals, completely co-occurring. The caterpillars cannot be told apart, and neither can the adults. They're rainforest and dry forest. They're everywhere, and they completely co-occur, and they have two totally different biologies, one eating one group of plants and the other eating another group of plants. Say, well, how many more of these are there like this? Well, you see the thing that says Agrius amidon up there in the upper right-hand corner? Up there, notice at the top of this NJ tree, there's a deep fork. Well, that's the deep fork right there. This is two species of Agrius amidon, not only co-occurring in the same place, but on the same food plant at the same time. It's as though mama of one came along and laid her egg on that plant, and when the mama of the other one came along and said, wow, that's the right plant for me too, and bang, there they are on the same plant at the same time. As a matter of fact, if you take taxonomists who are very good at their group and you give them a long list and say, predict where the barcodes will split up things, they'll pick out the things where there's been a lot of variation, there's been arguments, where there's polymorphism, those things, and they're generally right. That's where the barcodes do split up. And what they'll miss is the ones that everybody knows. The one with the big yellow spot on the wing, the one with the big blue stripe down it, the one with one big spine sticking out of the back of the head. Because those are the ones that turn out to be also having complexes in them. But you miss the complex because it had this real easy key character. And here's that one nice example. Everybody knows what Bibulus hyperia is. It was in the trees that we saw here earlier today in Andre's tree. It's a very well-known animal. It's three animals in the same place, on the same food plant, with identical caterpillars. And so far, I can't figure out any way to tell the adults apart, except by barcoding them, and they are very different. But the other side of this coin is there are a few things who have the same barcode, but are very different in appearance and morphology. And this is one very good one. Adelpha melanthi and Adelpha phylaca, different subgenera of Adelpha, are indistinguishable by their barcodes. And the caterpillars are very similar. The food plants are very similar as well. And my interpretation of this thing is that this thing is split apart very recently. Their barcodes haven't had time to separate from each other. But there's been strong selection. As we know, all Adelphas are mimics of somebody. And they has been strong selection for these two to diverge as adult appearances. Now, the barcode itself obviously has, it's like any tool. It's tricky. You have to learn how to use its tricks. And a very nice example is this pair of skippers. The upper one is just described by John Burns. And it's the clear dots in the tree on the left. There, and you'll see that there's one up in the middle, one down there, and then there's some black and white intermingled, and then white ones down here at the bottom, i.e. the barcodes are not separating this pair of very similar skippers. So what's wrong? Does the barcode fail? No. If you take and knock out all the short barcodes, the 350s, the 400s, the 450s, the 500s, and then redo your tree, you get perfect separation of these two species. They differ by one base pair. So if you don't pick up that one base pair difference, they get lumped together. But if you've got a nice, clean 650 base pair sequence for them, no problem telling them apart. So what happens when you get down to these nasty little things? You know, flies. All look like house flies, don't they? That's what tachinids are. Well, we've been spent 20 years doing, Bonnie Wood has been doing these things for 20 years, so we have a really good understanding from a morphological standpoint of what a lot of the tachinids look like. So you take those, remember I said in that tree earlier, in that slide earlier, there are 16 generalist tachinids that have these very long lists of caterpillars, each one of them. You know, 45 species into many families and so on. What happens when you barcode those? Well, this is the guy who does all the work at Guelph, Alex Smith, and you take one leg off, so the enormous number of five-legged flies in Canada now. And those 16 generalist species turned into 73 species. And people say, but do you believe that, Dan? Those 73 species match the caterpillar species, the hosts, extremely well. Extremely well. But there still are 9 generalists. So we still have John Lyell's generalists, but they're not as general as they were before. So you had some generalists with 45 species of caterpillars, and you barcode them, and suddenly all the ones who eat swallowtails are off on another branch. The barcode picks out that set. And then what happens is, you know what they look like. That's one morphological species of fly. And it's 9 barcode species, each one with its own host plant. I'm host caterpillar. So now what happens is you get this. If you take the two on the left, look at the width of the 3 black bands on the dorsal part of that segment in the middle of the abdomen, on the upper one, and then look at the width of the 3 black bands on the lower one. That's what was called variation. The one on the top eats Manduca delucida, one species of sphingid. The one on the bottom eats Manduca coralina. These grow side by side on 2 different food plants in the same forest. And that was all, of course, treated as Drinorrhea. It was just one species. When you barcode them, suddenly the taxonomist wants to go back now and look at every single individual that he looked at morphologically beforehand to see where they fit. And you decide, lo and behold, there's beautiful characters like this, but they were overlooked or they were dumped into the category called variation. Josephine is going to talk, Rodriguez is going to talk this afternoon about her ridiculous little Panleys black wasp. This is one species, the Panleys leucostigmus, that breaks up into 32 when you barcode them. And they all match their own individual caterpillars. So instead of being a generalist who ate basically all species of skippers, which is what everybody thought leucostigmus was, it's in fact a horrible complex of specialists, each one eating a small number of species of skippers. Now, this is a hyperparasite. This is in Trigonlita. This guy, mama goes along and lays her eggs on the leading edge of the leaf where the caterpillar is eating, and so it swallows the eggs, and then we go on through the parasitization of the tachinid who's inside the caterpillar. Okay, so they come out in different sizes depending on how big the tachinid was, but everybody knows that T. Gunlachii is sort of, you know, the hyper. It's from Pennsylvania all the way down into South America somewhere. Get it in Malay traps all the time. Very well known. Why? It's the bald eagle of the hyper parasites, right? So we barcode it. It's three things in one place. And you look carefully at the three things, and what you discover is one of them is in dry forest, one is in rainforest, and the other is a little pocket in the middle of the dry forest. And they're very different at the level genetically, but morphologically, they're dead on each other. When you go and look at a nuclear sequence, for those people who are worried about using mitochondrial DNA for this kind of identification process, it turns out that the rainforest one is at the nuclear sequence level different from the dry forest one. But the dry forest pocket disappears. So you can't tell them apart with a nuclear sequence, but you can tell them apart with CO1. So that's where we're headed. What do you need to make that work? You need the libraries against which you compare all this. And my plea to the entomological world is the same as to the plant world or the mammal world, the bird world is, stop dragging your feet, get on the bandwagon and make use of it by getting sequences for all your favorite bugs. So they're in the library, so when we have a sequencer of some sort, people then can reference to your animals from Alaska to Wisconsin to Brazil or whatever they happen to be. Second, we need the gadget. Now, the gadget's out of my control, it's out of your control, but these guys who love to do things in Silicon Valley, they'll make the gadget, okay? That'll come along of its own accord. The actual statement that's on the table right now is, Dan, put $10 million on the table and you have the gadget in 2 years. That's where technology is at this level. I can't control that. That's other people who do that. So what we have to do is we have to provide the sequence libraries. So when you stick a leg into a hole in the gadget that you pull out of your back pocket, there is a sequence somewhere that references to it. It's just all we're talking about really is gene bank in a bottle, okay? I think there should be a toll booth. Nobody seems to want to listen to this, but I'm going to say it anyway. I think that every time you put a leg in your gadget and you get a name back, a penny should drop in a bucket. And a bucket should be used to fund the taxonomic process that's behind all of this, okay? And finally, you need some place where there's information that you get when you have a name, which is what, of course, EOL is, what GBIF is, and all the other mechanisms by which your information gets to someone who puts the name in. The problem we have is that none of the computers, none of the cell phones, none of the handhelds, none of the BlackBerries at the present time have got the hole in it that you stick your leg in. You can't get the information out of Google that's there at the present time unless you have a taxonomist on a chain. Okay? I feel that bioliteracy, which is what you'll have when you can really identify anything, anywhere, anytime, has a potential relationship to wild biodiversity between people and wild biodiversity as real literacy has had between people. Now, there's a direct analogy here. To me, the barcoder, the gadget, and its library and all of the information behind it is equivalent to at least these things. Now, why would I make such a wild-eyed statement? I mean, obviously, in many ways, these are not the same thing. But they all have something in common. Every one of those things has something in common. The something they have in common is that there's something there for everybody. The housewife, the farmer, the game warden, the taxonomist, the graduate student, everybody has use for it. And they have use for these things. That's why the camera was developed back in the Civil War. How long did it take for there to be one in every house? 50, 70 years. And it was because Kodak decided, I'm going to put one in every house and every person can have their own camera. The same with the Model T Ford, the same with airplanes, all, and so on. So what we're really talking about is democratization of biodiversity. Thank you very much.
So we have time for questions, if anyone has questions for Dan and Winnie as well. So apparently we have lots of questions.
Yes, sir.
What do you consider to be a species?
For me, as an ecologist, the same thing I've always considered to be. It's a batch of individuals that are, at least potentially, and probably actually are, interbreeding with each other. And that's it.
But still, you would call morphologically, ecologically similar organisms different species because they have slightly different DNA. You haven't done any...
Because they have different DNA, they have different morphology, which you find when you look, but you overlooked beforehand, and they have different biologies. They eat different caterpillars, or they eat different food plants. So, in other words, for my entire ecologist life, if I knew nothing about genetics, and you came to me and you said, these are morphologically different, and they do different things, I would say, yeah, they're different species. I'm now adding another trait. Now once I've added the other trait, the genetic trait, I feel even happier to call it two different species. And furthermore, I will now use as a shorthand any one of those traits, morphology, or food plant, or genetics, to identify it, to actually say, aha, this individual belongs to that species, okay? And just as we do now when we don't use barcoding, I say to you, hear that bird call, you say, ah, that's a such and such. But how do you know? Well, because I know that bird call is correlated with a set of other traits, but I use the bird call as a key character. And I'm saying that I feel comfortable using the barcode trait as a key character, just like I use food plants, just like I use morphology as key characters. But to me, that's a key character for the Mia species, which is the set of individuals running around and courting and having babies and doing all of that stuff. And so if you ask, well, how do I know if the one in Cuba is a different species from the one on the mainland? I have the same problem I do with morphology. I don't know. But I have another trait, that's all. Yeah?
Yeah, I'm wondering how the greater resolution from the barcoding has changed your view of diversification of these organisms in Costa Rica.
Well, without doubt, it's changed my view in the sense of a lot of the things that I thought were sloppy are no longer sloppy. In other words, I had a moth who feeds on Proteaceae and feeds on Leguminosae. And I thought, yeah, that's really crazy. How can I have one species eating these two very different, chemically very different food plants? My barcode, I discovered that, oops, that's two different species. One specialized on Proteaceae, one specialized on Fabaceae. So the mystery's gone. It just cleans up a whole lot of, as an ecologist, it cleans up a whole lot of those relationships. And the second thing is that I now have a way of feeling much more certain about identifications. I'll be very blunt, and this is not to run anybody down, but I've been a collaborator with taxonomists my whole career. And we all make mistakes. And what I do routinely now is barcode everything. And what happens is then this set of specimens, which we thought came from here and were identified this way, come out of a different barcode. I take them back to the taxonomist, and we look carefully, and we say, my goodness gracious, this one over here, in fact, is different from this one over here based on morphology. And suddenly, I feel more confident about my statements of what I'm dealing with than I did before. So here we have a volcano in the middle. We got the same name on the top of the volcano and down here at the bottom. Is that really the same thing? Well, it was called the same thing because that's the level of the taxonomic resolution took it. We barcode them and discover there's a distinctive set of barcodes here and a distinctive set here. I take them back to the taxonomist. They look at it and say, ah, Dan, you know what? My goodness, you know, all the ones on the top have got three spines in the genitalia and the ones down below have two and a half spines. And I just thought that was variation, but in fact, it's consistent now that you've separated them this way. It could be done with morphology. It could be if we all took our morphology and just really ground it into the ground, you'd get the same results that I'm getting here. And the same for the ecology. With the acceptance of food plant, Mama does make mistakes on food plants now and then. She does put the eggs in the wrong place. Now that's different, and you can distinguish between the mistakes and the realities then. Oh, sorry. Yeah, Jack.
I've got a practical question, Dan. We've got this database of 300 million thousand specimen records over 100 years. What happens when you've had this well-known species that you've entered all these observational records for so long, you discover there's three different things? Practically, how do you manage that with all of those earlier records?
Right now, on a smaller scale of just 20 years of doing it with 350,000 records, what I'm doing at the moment is, let's say that thing that I've been doing has got one name on it. Well, you saw an example up here of Propona Laertes. What you probably didn't notice, it said Propona Laertes and it said DHJ01 fused on the Latin name here, and then it said Propona Laertes DHJ fused onto it. If you go in my database, you'll discover that three names. There's Propona Laertes with no DHJ 01 or 02, because those were ones
that, there won't be, and Laertes there are none, because once I discovered that one of them eats one food plant family and the other food plant eats the other food plant family, I named them accordingly. I used the food plant then as the character. But there are other parallel cases where there are three, because the early one, I have no specimens to barcode, or a parasite killed them, or they died of disease, so I don't know which one of the two is. So it sits there with that Latin name. And then the other two where I do, we barcode it, and I know that they're separate, and then they get this interim name stuck on it, DHJ01 and DHJ02. Later on, I have to do the same thing we do with morphology. What happens when you discover that there's two morphologically? Forget the barcode. What do? You go and you describe them, and just tough luck for all that previous literature. And I'm going to have exactly the same problem. Monty Wood has got his Drinopis of interest. The whole world knows what Drinopis of interest is. It's 21 species of flies. So his problem is, first off, can I find the type, if it exists? And maybe can we nail it down to one of the 21? Maybe, maybe not. And then the other 21, basically, you might have some synonym types, synonyms that are out there that can be resurrected and attached to one or the other. But the bottom line is all the early records that deal with Drinopis of interest, they are mixes. So you take the list of flies, if Drinopis of interest occurs in the United States, you take the list of caterpillars for Drinopis of interest in the United States in any one of the catalogs, it's nonsense. Or it's for this super, if you like a super species or some bigger word like that, that feeds on this list, but it's not a generalist anymore. It just isn't. And so, but you can't know who specific that record from in Southern Illinois, you can't know what animal that was that ate that caterpillar. So I don't have a real good pragmatic answer, but that's how I'm dealing with it. Yes, sir.
If we accept that barcoding is just another way of giving a better name to something, how does that imply when you get a group now that before was just a few species having some ecological function on some species or host, that someone says, well, what's the big concern? You've got so many on this planet, so it produced two or three good years. How do you correlate that on? I mean, okay, barcoding's great, and you can get the little thing for a whole bunch of people out of work, but that'll take many people on anyway, but you can go with that, but how do you then, what's the implication of that on a larger scale where, as my mom used to say, it's like a hermano go bajito, meaning that the low magnets, you gotta go higher in the tree, and so people are using South America, Central America, there's not the, there's sort of pressures coming from other areas. How do you bring that about?
Well, I don't deal with it because to me it's a parallel to what happened when we started looking at genitalia of insects. 50 years ago when people started using genitalia as a character, they discovered a jillion species that people didn't realize were there. What did we do about that? What we're just doing is discovering more diversity than we thought was there in the first place. And we have to deal with it in all the pragmatic way the pragmatic ways that we deal with more diversity. It's not because of the barcode isn't the problem. We're going to find more underneath it. I'm certain that we're overlooking a lot of species using CO1 as a key character. So I can't answer your question, but it's a generic question, which I don't feel responsible that I have to answer. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, I think there's a crazy perception that this puts taxonomists out of work. In fact, you could employ 30 follow-up on all of this for the descriptions in the formal work.
Absolutely. If one wanted to see this as a synergism, I'm providing enormous amount of work for taxonomists, and frankly, I'm trying very hard to raise large quantities of money to support large quantities of taxonomists. So, winning, go ahead.